Good morning. The open meeting for the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, May 9th, 2019 will now come to order. We have an interesting agenda today, and I believe we have some late submitted documents. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to, that the Commission may consider the late submission of agenda documents number 18-43-D, 19-18-A, and 19-19-A.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents to consider the late submitted documents. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And the motion passes unanimously. First item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2018-12. We now have four different drafts on this one. Mr. Toner, Ms. Zair, if you would like to come to council table. I believe that there will be questions. Mr. Wensinger, did you have anything that you would like to say to us at the opening?
Sure, might as well give a little rundown.
Give us the history. How did you get here?
Agenda documents 1843A, B, C, and new draft D are draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Defending Digital Campaigns. The requester asks whether it may provide or facilitate the provision of certain cybersecurity services, software, and hardware to federal candidate committees and national party committees on a nonpartisan basis and according to predetermined objective criteria. Drafts A, C, and D conclude that the proposal is permissible, while draft B concludes that the proposal is impermissible. Since the last open meeting, we received one comment from the requester on draft C, and I'm happy to answer any questions that any of you have.
Thank you, Mr. Wensinger. I believe we probably have questions for Mr. Toner and Ms. Zair. Thank you for coming back. We appreciate it. We know you've been back several times on this, and we are always happy to see a former colleague.
If I can get the technology right. The facilities are so beautiful, Madam Chair. It's always a pleasure for Ms. Zair and I to be here.
And we're always happy to see you. So we were trying very hard to get closer and closer to giving you an answer. I think everyone agrees that what you are trying to do is a worthwhile endeavor. The question is how to work it into our legal framework. And in your latest comment, you clarified that you would, the client is planning on seeking corporate contributions in cash and in kind, which makes it a little harder for some of us. That raises a new concern. And one of the concerns that I have goes to disclosure. And I know that your client has made the commitment to disclose the donors. Could you tell me a little bit more about how you envision that working?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. First of all, I think we appreciate the agency's consideration of this matter over many months and really appreciate the efforts of everyone involved in this matter. So our clients are very committed to full transparency in terms of the contributions that are raised for this effort. I think what they envisioned, obviously it turned on the outcome of the advisory opinion in terms of the requirements the commission might set out, but I think what they were contemplating was disclosure on our client's website, perhaps really paralleling the same kind of disclosure information that registered committees operate with under FECA. We haven't discussed internally the particulars of how all that disclosure would look like, but the concept would be to provide the public with the same transparency and information in terms of fundraising that other political committees provide as well, and do it on the through the internet on the website, so they would be available for people in real time.
In real time, so in advance of any elections that, in this case, the 2020 election.
Right, and that's right, Madam Chair. And if, for example, if the commission wanted to set out a reporting schedule or indicate that we should follow the same schedule as a political committee, you know, a quarterly filing or something along those lines, my sense is that our clients are very supportive of that, very supportive of that.
Well, that's helpful. One distinction between your client and a political committee, of course, is that, as we've just discussed, your client is planning to accept corporate contributions. Now, I'm not sure exactly whether you have thought through, or your client has thought through, what kind of corporations you're talking about. I mean, because if we're talking about business corporations, then, you know, you disclose the name of the business corporation, and that pretty much answers the question of where the money is coming from. But one concern that I have is if, for example, your C4 were to accept contributions or donations from another C4, then we would not have the same kind of transparency that we get with political committees who aren't allowed to accept that kind of money. Well, super PACs are, but campaign committees and party committees aren't. And those groups have been a venue in the past for hiding donors from the public, and I would have a lot of concerns if this were to turn into another venue for dark money to be used, even for a commendable purpose, but still to be used in a way that could potentially influence members of Congress, because they would be getting something of value from these sources and the public would not be clued in as to where it was really coming from. So can you speak to whether you envision that possibility happening, whether your client is planning on soliciting from C4s and other groups that aren't as immediately transparent about where the money's coming from?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, as we indicated in perhaps the last time we were here, you know, our client has not been building out a fundraising plan, in part because, you know, our client really wanted to see how this advisory opinion turned out. But the two directives that our client has really emphasized to Ms. Zara and I, and also to Mr. Elias and his colleagues at Perkins Coie, is they're committed to transparency and disclosure, and whatever conditions the agency decides to establish in that area in terms of how frequently that disclosure should be or the level of detail. My sense is that they're really committed to that, and also committed, as we indicated in our written materials, to accepting no contributions from foreign nationals. But otherwise, you know, they really have not been building out their fundraising plan because they're waiting to see how the agency rules on this advisory opinion as a whole.
So what I'm taking from that is that you don't really know whether they might be either planning now or whether they might, if the option were available to them, might end up soliciting C4 groups that would not necessarily be as transparent about where the money was ultimately coming from.
There's been no discussion about soliciting particular corporate entities or 501c4s because, again, our client hasn't turned to fundraising strategies or development at this stage. Instead, is waiting to see if the agency approves the proposal as a whole. But DDC very committed to meeting the disclosure obligations that the commission might establish here in this advisory opinion. Very committed to that.
I don't want to hog the mic. Do any of my colleagues have any? Commissioner Walther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to see you here again.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good to see you.
I'm sharing the same issue as the chair in that you had me on draft C, and on this, it seems to me put a somewhat of a kink in there, and I'm mostly because it's probably a non-clear kink in the future what it might look like. But to have it say indicating that DDC may at some future point consider accepting monetary donations from sources other than individuals and foundations. And I think on one point you said, if necessary, maybe that was in a previous draft. But my concern again is that this is a little bit last minute to consider that new factor, and I'm wondering if maybe we could take enough time to not say no, but to at least just help figure out how we could put some meat on the bones.
Commissioner, absolutely. And I think a couple things, differentiating between sort of in-kind provisions of goods and services and direct contributions. So as you know, in our original advisory opinion request, we went into some detail about the framework of working with a wide variety of entities for the provision of goods and services. What would typically be seen as an in-kind contribution if the activity were a contribution in the first place. And so that's definitely the heart of what DDC would like to do. But then, as we indicated the last time we were here and then in our written comments, in terms of direct contributions, there just have been no plans thus far to seek contributions from corporate entities or entities beyond individuals and foundations. But DDC would like to have the potential ability to consider that in the future if it did become necessary. So that's sort of where they are on that side of things.
Well, it's just, it seems to me that with a little bit of work, we could make it work. We, as you can tell, we've all been working on this one. And we want to make sure we can get this thing through because of the need to have it. We know all of you. We know that, you know, it's a chance to do this with maybe just a little stretch here and a little stretch there. But on this one right now, I just would wonder if maybe we couldn't put a fine point on this. And I don't know how much of a hurry you are, but maybe we come back at the next meeting and see if we can't have something that will have some thought given to it.
No, absolutely. We like I said earlier, we really appreciate everyone's efforts on this matter, and our client's committed to providing as much time as the agency might need to grapple with these issues.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Toner, is there for the information that you've provided to us and for the efforts that that have been taken to try to reach a consensus on this. I guess I'm a little concerned about, this is now the third meeting at which we've considered this matter, and there seems to be a pattern that's developing where we get here, talk, appear to be close, but not quite there, say, well, we just need a little more time, and then we get to the next meeting, another issue arises, that the can has been getting kicked down the road quite a number of times now, and I'm wondering whether or not it seems as if the modification, you said you were on draft C, and the modification that we see in draft D is relatively modest, so it's not that we are looking at an extensive change that I think requires an inordinate amount of thinking and time to take into account. Is there a specific thought that you had that would address your concerns? Because if you were on draft C, it seems like the difference between draft C and draft D are relatively minor, and frankly, don't change the analysis in any meaningful way. And so I'm wondering if there's something that we might be able to discuss here in the now that might actually be able to resolve this for the commission, allow the requester to have the security of an advisory opinion. Because it seems like what might be necessary wouldn't require a tremendous amount of a heavy lift or an extensive amount of a language change. And so I want to ask my colleague what he might envision and whether or not we might be able to get to a yes now rather than having to kick the can down the road another time and risk potentially running into the same problem at that meeting as well.
I mean, we all know each other where we pretty much are, but this is something that I just read a few hours ago, so I think it's a new consideration. It's not kicking the can down the road very far, but you can call it what you want. But it is potentially, not right for today, but maybe for tomorrow, we'll regret the fact that we had it so open-ended. So I'm just interested in trying to tie it down and still make it realistically. I wouldn't worry about the vote sliding. We know pretty much where we are. My sense is we settled pretty close on draft C, but I'm not sure until we vote, of course. So I'd like to give us till the next meeting to see if we couldn't. We give some thought, see if we can tie it down now rather than some later date.
Did you have a further comment, Mr. Vice Chairman?
I'm just saying that I'm concerned about the time that we've taken on this so far, and how long it's taken us. I mean, this is the third meeting at which we've considered this. We have four drafts. The comment came in the door on Monday. It wasn't an extensive comment. The edit that was made to the draft was not an extensive edit. I'm just concerned that that this process is starting to develop a certain pattern, and I'm wondering if we are going to be able to successfully bring this to a conclusion, or if there are concerns that we don't think that you're going to be able to find some comfort on. I don't know. I'm wondering how much more time you anticipate needing.
Well, I think Commissioner Walther has asked that we take until the next meeting. I appreciate your concern on the timeliness of this. Timeliness is always a concern for me as well. You know, I suppose commissioners can differ as to whether receiving new information on Monday is adequate time to fully consider all the ramifications by Thursday. But, you know, one issue that has been really important for Commissioner Walther and for me has been the disclosure aspect. I recognize that that has not been as key a factor for all of the commission. But for some of us, the representation that the requester was willing to disclose the donors is a very key fact and is, in fact, essential to getting four votes. So whether it is spelled out, whether there are stipulations in the draft or not, it's going to take all of us to be on the same page in order to get a yes answer. And two of us think that disclosure is essential. So, you know, unless we are comfortable with the disclosure, there probably won't be those four votes. And adding in corporate, the possibility of corporate solicitations, you know, I think it is less of a concern on the in-kind side of, you know, getting corporate employees to, you know, to donate their time. And in fact, you know, I think that's the tech community owns a little bit of the problem that has been created here. So if the tech community wants to step up and donate services to help fix the problem, I think that's not a bad result. But when we start talking about soliciting cash and soliciting cash from, we don't know from whom, but from potentially dark money sources, that raises red flags for some of us. And, you know, if your client were willing to make representations that they weren't going to be soliciting that kind of money, then, you know, that would, I think, make it easier for, I don't want to speak for Commissioner Walther, but it would certainly alleviate concerns for me. So I think that's kind of where we are.
I'd like to know if
Commissioner Hunter,
Mr. Toner, or Ms. Sarah have a comment about that.
Well, two things. When is the next commission meeting? Is it in two or three weeks? Do we know when that is?
Well, we have a calendar coming up.
6 weeks?
No, I was just kidding.
No, it's it looks like it is in 2 weeks, the 23rd.
23rd of May. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just I didn't have that in front of me.
Yes.
So, I mean, a couple of, like I said earlier, our clients, the direction they've given to us is to be fully committed to disclosure and whatever parameters the agency establishes in that area. That's really where our client is. They've been at that place throughout the process, and they agree that having transparency in this area is really vital. So I think that's where they are, and whatever conditions the agency might put in the disclosure area, I think they're committed to meeting.
Well, I think it's probably not going to work quite that way, because I don't think there will be four votes to put conditions on disclosure in the draft. In fact, you know, we've already had a lot of back and forth on that aspect of the advisory opinion behind closed doors, and you know, I thought that the draft should be more closely tied to a specific requirement on disclosure. That was not going to get four votes. So I don't think it will be a question of the commission laying out conditions, because we won't have four votes to lay out conditions. It's going to work the other way around, where what representations is the requester able to make that would secure four votes? If you catch my drift here.
Right. But you can appreciate, Madam Chair, we're here to seek the direction of the agency.
However
you come out on it, we're going to respect. I mean, that's the reality. And what our clients have emphasized is disclosure on the internet in regular intervals, for example, the same type of disclosure schedule that a political committee operates with, they're very comfortable with. And so that's their direction to us on that.
And it may well be that, you know, they might hear about this discussion and say, oh, well, if that's their concern, then you know, we're happy to represent that we're not going to solicit money from dark money groups, however you want it. I assume it wouldn't be framed in exactly that way. And that might be very helpful. Again, I don't want to speak for Commissioner Walther. It would be helpful to me. And I would rely on those representations in issuing the advisory opinion. I want to ask a question just sort of to go back to something we were talking about last time. And forgive me if, I don't think I asked this exact question last time, but we talked about the possibility of the party committees paying for these kinds of services and making them available to their candidates. Have you given any thought to using, say, the building funds as, you know, sort of defining building as including the hardware, software, cybersecurity apparatus? Thought about going down that road, maybe?
So a couple things. I think, Madam Chair, there was a dialogue on that the last time we were here. I think Mr. Elias, there was an exchange who shared that there was some suspicions on the Democratic side in terms of the ability of the DNC and the other national party committees to play this kind of role, which obviously I'm not equipped to speak to. But I do remember there was a dialogue there, and the sense that, or maybe it was Mr. Mook that was detailing this, but I remember there was someone who was talking about this idea that at least in the Democratic campaign community, it was hard for them to see the DNC or the National Democratic Committees being able to play that kind of role. So obviously, I defer to my Democratic colleagues on that, and I'm not aware of any specific consideration of using a building fund type concept. No.
But you haven't talked to the party committees about that?
I have not, no.
I mean, the client?
Right, no. Not to my knowledge, no. No.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. So it seems as if there's two separate issues. One, what the chair and Commissioner Walther call disclosure. You've already represented that you will provide full disclosure. It's in your representations. It seemed like everyone was okay with that representation because it sounds like I don't want to speak for anyone, but it sounded like we had four votes for draft C. So it seems like disclosure is not really the issue. The issue is, are you going to take money from so-called dark money groups? And I guess that's related in your mind to disclosure.
Yeah.
So you have the ability to do so, of course, as a 501C, but you're hearing concern from my colleagues that they don't want you to do that. And you're saying, I don't know yet because we haven't gotten that far. But I'm trying to figure out what kind of condition you're asking him to put in his representations. I don't know if I were Toner what I would go back to my client and say. They just don't like certain kind of corporations is kind of what I'm hearing. Corporations don't disclose their donors. So I'm not really sure what he's supposed to do.
Well, that's the point.
Okay.
That corporations don't disclose their donors. Now, business corporations don't have donors. They've got, you know, customers. But people understand where the money's coming from when you're dealing with a business corporation. When you're dealing with C4s, it's a different story.
So I don't want to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
So you're okay if they take money from, I'm sorry, you call them business corporations?
I would probably be okay with what they're proposing, even with the addition of taking money from corporations, if we were talking about business corporations And they would be disclosed, and you know that would obviate my concerns that this would become another venue for, as I said, undisclosed donors to be providing things of value to members of Congress, and you know the public being left in the dark about that.
And I do think, Madam Chair, that that framework could work really well for us, what you just sketched out, because like I said earlier, I don't think there's any active consideration of soliciting funds from however we might want to define dark money organizations. So for example, if the agency, if there were four votes to approve one of these drafts, we have so many here I can't keep them straight, but one of these drafts that detailed the disclosure side of things and the fact that DDC would have the ability to have the option of soliciting contributions from for-profit business corporations, but that DDC currently doesn't have any plans to solicit contributions from or accept contributions from, however you want to define it, dark money or trade association or however you want to define that. I think that could work very well.
Honestly, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if that, because, there's a lot of money in the business community. I wouldn't be surprised if that was what, you know, the client had in the back of their mind that, you know, maybe they would want to go to the business community for donations for something like this.
And we'd be supportive of an adoption of an opinion along those lines if there's consensus in that area with those distinctions. We would be.
So as long as they're in the conditions, and we've established that the conditions are good enough for people, your toner's saying he might be able to go back and add that in there. So for-profit business corporations are okay. I don't know how you would define the people who aren't okay. So maybe you just... did we say foundations were okay? I can't remember.
Yes.
Foundations are okay?
And if, you know, by your question, I'll just kind of, you know, jump ahead on that. If your suggestion is that foundations can also be a venue
right,
for
that's
dark money,
right.
You're right.
Right, but, I was thinking of the Kellogg Foundation, and I don't think they disclose their donors.
No, I think you're right, and that's also a concern, but foundations have at least the protection that they operate under C3 of the tax code.
So do you want to say C3s and for-profit business corporations, if Toner's client agrees to that, are okay with you?
Where would that leave LLCs? I'm trying to think of all the entities that have been problematic in other contexts. I think LLCs could also be a problem, but I think this is resolvable.
Well, I think it's helpful with, you know, to have the clients here, to have the requesters here, you know. So I think Peterson's suggestion of trying to, you know, talk it through now is a good one, because I don't want us to be, you know, sitting here next week trying to figure out what we want to ask Toner for. So. Again, so far, for-profit business corporations are okay, C3s are okay, LLC, so...
But not C4s, C6s, LLCs. And again, I'm just speaking for myself now. Commissioner Walters also asked for more time to think about this, and I don't want to... I don't want to jump in front of him.
Well, I think those are all items to work through. I don't think right now is the time, but definitely we want to help you get this thing off the road. So I can remember when I first got on the commission, and there's Mr. Toner, and we went in. I was going to make some suggestions, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I had real strong views about it. And we went through, and he kept nodding me how much, what a great idea I had, And I'll be darned if I didn't give him about half of them or more. And that is really a good person to negotiate with. But that was some time ago.
You're too kind, Commissioner.
Well,
some time ago, that's right. The other element there's been some discussion about is potentially seeking government grants. That's obviously very different than the flow of money we're talking about now. But for example, if there were government grants to help assist DDC in this effort, they might think about applying for those grants.
Yeah, I don't see that as problematic. since I would be happy if the government funded the whole thing.
You know, through State Department or Department of Homeland Security, there might be some grant-making authority where they might seek some funds from the government in that manner.
So in this framework, the Chamber of Commerce, which I think is a C6, wouldn't be able to participate?
That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But any member of the Chamber of Commerce could.
As long as they were a for-profit business corporation.
Isn't that who joins the Chamber of Commerce?
I think that's mostly, but I'm not sure if they have any non-for-profit organizations. Probably not.
I honestly don't know.
I'm not sure.
Commissioner, former Commissioner Toner has been around the block on these issues of transparency and money flowing through organizations. I suspect he understands my concerns here.
It's like Groundhog Day. Where's Bill Murray if we're not talking about transparency and flows of money through multiple entities?
Do we have any other questions, comments?
So would it,
Commissioner Hunter?
Commissioner Walther, would you like me to add that language in now, or do you want to?
No, I want to have time to consider it for the next meeting.
So what I propose that.
And if you have some new ideas, you know, based upon how you've heard that we've considered things in, you know, government grants or whatever might, as you're thinking about it, and it sounds to me like your clients are still working on how they're want to go for at least the time being. So if we can embellish on that, that'd be great too. But I'm not inclined to hold you guys up. I just want to refine this based upon this new information.
Another possible way of getting at it would be limiting it to C corps. It's been a long time since I cracked open a corporate law book, but that might be another path.
So in lieu of for-profit business corporations?
I think C corps might capture it.
Well, I don't know what's wrong with describing it in that way.
I mean, well, I think there could be some LLCs who are for-profit business corporations.
And we don't like LLCs now? Oh yeah, that was in the no category. Sorry.
LLCs have been a venue for dark money in other circumstances that have come before the commission. I know that you're not as concerned about dark money as I am, Commissioner, but it's a concern for some of us. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to, while we still have Mr. Toner and Ms. Ayer here, just want to confirm that this is the sticking point at this point. Are there any other issues that we need to hash out now while we have them here that might give us some useful guidance going forward so that we don't unearth another issue that's going to be a tripping point the next time along? Is there anything else? Or is this really the financing issue? If we can hammer this out, do we anticipate that this is kind of the final hurdle?
This is the only issue I'm concerned about.
Okay.
Yeah, for me, it's all about disclosure.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Commissioner Hunter.
So what I'd like to do is circulate a draft E, maybe this afternoon, adding the language that we just discussed, basically to the same place where we added the language requested by the requester in the comment submitted earlier this week, and see if that works for people.
So, well, what the amendment talked about, what the comment said. So are you suggesting that this would be a requirement that the commission would say?
No, because that's not where we added the last language.
No, it isn't, but we don't have that representation yet from the requester, so we can't put words in their mouth.
That's true. So once we hear back, just trying to figure out the timing, you know, like what comes first. So I guess, but he can't react to what we're putting in there until he knows what's in there. So why don't we put it in first, and then the requester can say yay or nay. Instead of waiting for him to comment, he doesn't know what we want to put in there. He would just be guessing, just like the rest of us. So we'll try to put something in there this afternoon, see if it's okay with our colleagues. If it is, we'll make it blue, and then the requester can comment. How's that?
Happy to consider draft E.
Does
Does that sound like a plan?
Absolutely. And we would plan to provide comments just like we did in the last round of drafts. Absolutely, Commissioner.
Okay.
And who knows, you know, maybe you'll come up with the magic formulation and we'll be happy and they'll say that works for us and we could even do it on tally before the next meeting.
Well, I'm just going to add the stuff that we talked about. I don't know how magic it is unless somebody has any other ideas. But yeah, maybe we could do it on tally. That'd be great.
I think that's the best words in the English language, tally vote. It sounds real good right now.
It does, doesn't it? It frequently sounds really good to me, Commissioner, but you know, it's hard to achieve around here, particularly because we have lost the ability with only four of us to have somebody just object for the record and, you know, move it along. We all have to be on board. Any further comments, questions? Okay, then. Well, thank you. It was very useful having you come in again. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And we really appreciate the consideration here and the issues that we're working through.
We are trying to get there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda, I'll speak slowly so people can move back and forth, is draft advisory opinion 2019-05 from Systems 73. Mr. Engel, I see you sitting back there. Would you like to join us up here? I have a feeling that you might have comments based on the comments that you sent in to us. Ms. Gilmeyer.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you is Agenda Document 19-18-A, a draft advisory opinion responding to a request from System 73, which is an incorporated communications technology network. The requester asks whether it may pay a political committee a license fee for the exclusive rights to live stream the committee's political event. The draft concludes that the proposal would result in prohibited corporate contributions because, one, the proposal does not meet the requirements for the media exemption because System 73 would not be acting within the scope of a legitimate media function in paying a political committee for this access, and, two, the proposal is not otherwise permissible because it would result in fundraising for the committee. We did not receive any comments on the request. We received one comment on the draft from the requester. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Engel, I know that you have comments, so we might as well start with you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that, and it's good to be here. My inaugural
welcome.
Visit.
Oh, to the new building. Well, yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, the General Counsel's office is right that those are the two issues boiled down into two sentences that will turn whether this advisory opinion is, you know, approved or not. The first one is on page 11, and it's on lines 19 through 21. And it says, System 73 would not be acting within the scope of a legitimate media function in paying the committee for this access. And there is no citation to that sentence or for that sentence. And then the second point that the council raised was at the bottom of that page 11, line 23, up to the next page, System 73 would not only stream a committee's events, but would also pay the committee a license fee, which would be a, quote, mechanism for raising funds for the candidates. One citation to support that, and that's Milothe at page 7. So going in reverse order, I'd like to look at Milothe at page 7 and see what they were talking about there. On page 7 in Milothe, when they were talking about a mechanism for raising funds for the candidate, they said on page 7 at the bottom of that top paragraph, providing a mechanism for raising funds for a candidate is not a typical press function. So adding a contribution page or providing a permanent hyperlink to an appropriate website where viewers may make contributions would not be covered by the press exemption, meaning you cannot say you are a part of the press when you're facilitating the making of other people's contributions by providing hyperlinks or some sort of mechanism for them to donate money. So then I want to jump to the advisory opinion request that I submitted on page 4, which says, System 73 does not presently provide any fundraising functionality with its live streaming technologies. Its political committee customers will need to continue to use their own existing systems to generate contributions. Melothe may be a nice citation for that sentence, but it is not applicable here because we kind of thought about this before we submitted it. Now, I will admit that I did not spend much time in the advisory opinion request addressing the first point about whether a license fee paid in the media industry is typical in the media industry. I didn't do that because it is so obvious that that's what happens every day in the media industry that it barely was worth commenting on. I was waiting for my chance to come up here. I pulled up, you know, another 8 articles on my phone about the enormity of media and licensing fees, and that's how Netflix works, Hulu works, the NFL works, half the shows on CBS work, that the broadcasters pay third parties a license fee for their content, and then while broadcasting their content, generate advertising revenue. It happens every minute of every day on nearly every channel that you can watch. And it happens in music. It happens on Broadway. It is the way the industry works. So I do apologize for not being more diligent in my advisory opinion request about saying that license fees are the way the world works, because I thought that that was obvious. But I want to be on the record as saying license fees are the way the world works. So those are just two small comments, but I think they go to the heart of the matter, which is, are you in the media business? Can you pay a license fee? Yes. Are we planning on facilitating the making of contributions? No.
So, if I go to, I was going to name a store name, but I won't, so as not to put any commercial endorsements on the record. If I go to a store and I buy a T-shirt, you know, it's a normal commercial transaction. I'm getting a T-shirt, a thing of value, and I'm paying money for it. But if I buy a T-shirt from a campaign committee, that's campaign contribution, even though I'm still getting a T-shirt. And maybe, and this has happened to me, I'm just buying it because I like the pattern on the T-shirt. When I was young and naive, I didn't even realize I was making a political contribution when I bought the T-shirt. So my point being that, you know, political committees, when they receive income, when they sell things, they're kind of on a different footing from other folks that provide things of value and get paid for them, because often it does result in a political contribution, even though in other settings it wouldn't. So why isn't the license fee to broadcast the campaign event a campaign contribution in the same way that buying the T-shirt at the campaign event would be a campaign contribution?
I think there are a couple of answers to that. The first one is, the individual who buys the T-shirt at a campaign event knows exactly what's going on. They're buying a T-shirt they're making a contribution.
Well, I'm telling you, I didn't the first time. That was when I was much younger, but.
We'll put something in the record.
That I was once young and very naive, okay.
That the campaign events that I've been to also recently make you fill out a donor card when you buy a T-shirt.
And good for them.
Here you have a like-kind exchange, a quid pro quo, a corporate contribution in exchange for an equal asset coming back to that corporation, which would be the exclusive rights to be the broadband broadcaster of the event. That truly is the like-kind exchange.
Still not entirely getting why it's not like the T-shirt.
Well, a T-shirt is a political contribution. Buying a ticket at an event, that's a political contribution. You are an individual, and you are wanting to support that candidate. System 73 doesn't care.
So does it by intent?
Doesn't care who the candidate is. They don't care. They want to do it for all the candidates. That's why this is so exciting for them to be able to have 22 or 23 presidential channels that everybody can sign up and get a System 73 channel for their presidential campaign.
Commissioner
Under. I'm just curious. I didn't really think about this until we started talking about the T-shirts. And I know what the rules are. If you buy a T-shirt, it's considered a campaign contribution. But I remember when the RNC, I was at the RNC when we first started talking about this, and the RNC decided not to sell T-shirts because they didn't want to deal with all that. But does anybody remember if there is an opinion from here on point saying that the purchase of the T-shirt is completely a contribution? Because I have a vague recollection that there it might just be the profit. That, you know, why is it the full price of the T-shirt and not just any profit that there might be? Profit would be a contribution and not just whatever the T-shirt cost.
I don't think that's the way it works. I could understand an argument that that's the way it should
work.
Well,
I know that's not the way it works, but that's in part because that's what people just decided to do.
I do think there's authority for that. I'll look at it while you all continue
okay.
to discuss.
Thank you. And I want to know if they got into that fine point about, you know, at the outset of this conversation, which was a while ago, but, you know, I guess it was after BCRA.
Well, it probably goes, you know, they've been selling T-shirts for a long time, so I suspect
it wasn't an issue until after BCRA, because the RNC could
why not?
Take, I don't remember right now.
I can guarantee you the T-shirt that I bought when I was young and naive was pre-BCRA, because... Yeah. You know, I wasn't that young when BCRA passed. Council, do you have something for us?
Yes. So it's in 11 CFR 100.53, and it says the entire amount paid to attend a fundraiser or other political event and the entire amount paid as the purchase price for a fundraising item sold by a political committee is a contribution. And that's regulation is cited.
Who wrote that reg?
That's an old one, I think.
That's fine with me because it talks about fundraising items. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's not what we're dealing with here.
Commissioner Peterson, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I congratulate you on coming up in conjunction with your client with a very innovative approach and one that has caused me to do a lot of deep thinking on this issue. I can't say that I've, because of the unusual nature of the request, and as I think you pointed out, this is an innovative proposal that you've put together. The rule of thumb that I've always understood, and and correct me if my if my understanding, and to the extent that I'm oversimplifying it, is that you make a payment to a political committee, that payment is going to be considered a contribution with certain exceptions. So the example of the hats, the books, the T-shirts, those the payment to get into an event. Maybe the event has entertainment, but still, even though there might be a fair market value, the amount that you're paying to that political committee is considered a contribution. There are some exceptions to that general rule of thumb regarding mailing lists, regarding sale of committee assets when the committee is maybe going, you know, is disbanding and getting rid of computers and old office equipment and so forth. Is that an oversimplification of the rule of thumb?
Yes.
And walk me through why that, why there is more room for a political committee to receive a payment of this sort without that being considered a contribution.
First of all, it starts with the reason that we're all here, which is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. That's the whole reason we have the artifice that we have. And if you ask yourself, what kind of corruption am I promoting by prohibiting System 73, you're not going to get a good answer, because there is no corrupting element to a corporation that wants to be in the political media business if it does it on an even-handed basis and consistent as a legitimate media function. So the lack of any corrupting influence here is where I start in looking at transactions between entities and political committees. The second thing is, I think it's time for us to recognize that the content of political speech and candidates' time and appearances have value. They don't have to give it away anymore. The traditional media has made a fortune off of requiring candidates to give them their time, to give them access to their speeches, and sometimes even change the time and location of speeches in order for them to get their camera crews there. Well, that imbalance is just that, an imbalance, that a terrific speech by a candidate has value. We know that because people watch it and people cover it as news. And in order to be the exclusive taker of that value for broadband purposes, you should be required to give them something in exchange for that. When you look at, here's an example. Let's say I represent a man who has ran for the Senate and been elected two or three times. And the History Channel comes to our office and says, we would like footage of his campaign appearances, because we're putting together a documentary thing, and we want some to see him in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and like, you have footage that you can give us. And as the campaign's lawyer, I say, yeah, we do have footage. Here it is. Now give me a license agreement. Tell me how much you're going to pay me for this footage and what you're going to do with it. Because I'm not going to give it over for free, and I'm not going to give it over for strings attached. Now, I do not think anybody in this room would say that the History Channel can't have a transaction with a campaign committee if it's putting together a documentary and looking for campaign footage. But I also don't think anybody in this room would think that the History Channel could get away with that for free. That's not the way it works. That is not the way the creation of third-party content on television works. It works through license agreements for the use of creative content, which is then recouped by the sale of advertising.
this is no different than the NFL. This is no different than something on Netflix. It is a broadcaster looking around for opportunities to purchase things and get an exclusive right to then rebroadcast them for a profit.
I'm not sure. Could I ask you a question about this business model? Because I'm not sure I understand how this is going to work. You're talking about an exclusive license fee. Are you suggesting that candidates would then ban every other media entity from covering their rallies or events because they have this exclusive Mm-mm. arrangement with System 73?
No. Mm-mm. Exclusive broadband provider. If, you know, CNN and NBC and others want to set up their cameras and put it on their channels, that's great. But we're talking about being the exclusive broadband licensee for your presidential channel on System 73. And the other thing that System 73 provides that the other cameras aren't going to provide is interactivity. Because what we have done is we have created the best of the internet and the best of cable. You get uninterrupted, high-quality broadband broadcasting, just like you're watching, you know, a television show, with the functionality of the internet, where you can be watching and then hit prompts on your screen to say, I like that sentence, I didn't like that sentence, I'm hot, I'm cold. So it allows the audience to interact. And what does it also do? It gives the candidates more exposure to their supporters and maybe even to the undecided. I mean, the number one thing that I've heard from the candidates that I've spoken to is that we don't get enough coverage. The media is too favorite. We get clipped and edited. If I could only just get through, I'm sure I would get more support. Well, this is how you get through. You get through as a candidate by using what the rest of the industry and the rest of the world is doing, which is licensing your content through an exclusive broadband channel.
CBS covers it and they, you know, have it on CBS.com?
Yeah, if CBS has it on CBS.com, that's fine. If CBS was there and had their camera, God bless them.
So how is it exclusive then?
We're talking about a broadband channel for, you know, Walther for President. That's CBS. Hey, you know.
It could happen.
It's happened.
My vote.
That's not on Walther for President channel. That's on CBS. And that's where all the noise is. And the other thing about it is on CBS, their live stream and their broadband, and certainly their network, is not unlimited. Things roll off your, you know, like with Netflix, for example, you have to hurry up and finish watching a show because you heard that at the end of the week they're going to be taking such and such off of Netflix. Why is that? Is that because Netflix has got only so big? No, they're pretty big. It's because the license expired.
But what you're describing, when you talk about how the candidates say, oh, if only I could get access to, you know, broadband so my full message could come through, now you're really convincing me that the candidates are really getting something of value, that the, you know, it's not that the candidates should be paid for this. It's almost, it seems more appropriate that they would be paying for this, that they want this exposure. It's not as if the candidates are saying, oh, you know, we have too many cameras following us around. They want all the cameras, mm-hmm. all the time, all the publicity that they can possibly get. And it just seems counterfactual
to suggest
that they need to be paid in order to have their content made more available.
No, that's really not it.
I can't write a contract with a candidate to say, you give me exclusive rights to your speeches and I give you nothing. A contract has to have two equal exchanges to it. And if you sign up with us, you can buy from us a lot of the interactivity functions that I talked about so that you can know who is watching, where they were hot or not, or what they didn't like. The functionalities that are going to be available here on the Walther for President presidential channel are going to be great. You're going to be getting a lot of data back.
Which is why Walther for President should pay for it.
Well, they are paying for it. Remember, they are paying for the functionality charges. In the advisory opinion, I said there is a second set of services that we can provide, and they have to pay for those.
But even being on the channel from the get-go sounds like something that would be extremely valuable to candidates.
Well, we hope so. But that doesn't mean that they have to give it away just because it's extremely valuable. I mean, look, being on a CNN town hall, for example, it's one of the biggest complaints that some of the younger candidates or lesser candidates say, that we're not getting on.
Careful there. Some of those younger candidates are pretty hot.
Yeah. And the inequality that is attributed to some people by who CNN allows access to or not is exactly what I'm trying to prevent. Everybody gets a shot. Everybody gets a shot at having their own channel and having a chance at all of the interactive functions that having your own channel has. And we do it just like everybody else in the industry is doing it, through license agreements.
Commissioner Hunter.
I think maybe this helps. So candidate Y, who's sort of what you called a lesser, I can't remember what the word is.
Younger.
Younger, lesser known, whatever. There's 23 candidates now on the Democrat side. So candidate, one of the lesser known candidates, they might get a little clip on CNN, but they're not getting their entire speech run. And you said, well, why can't CBS go video them? They can, but they don't, because nobody wants to watch the entire speech of somebody who's a not so popular candidate. So Craig's not preventing CBS by showing up and videoing their entire speech at the fish fry in Iowa. But again, they're not showing up because the guy it's not bringing enough revenue for them to send the camera, set up, and do all this kind of stuff. So the service they're providing films that guy's entire speech and then pays him for the use of being able to stream it, and then he can then buy back services to allow his viewers, his supporters, or undecideds to watch him give the full speech. Because if they don't have that service, either there's a little teeny snippet or nobody shows up at all.
Well, you could put it on YouTube. You could put the entire speech on YouTube.
But it's going to be like somebody with their phone, videoing the speech on YouTube. They don't have the ability to provide a good video service that can then be streamed out. It's going to be sort of, man on the street kind of video. Yeah, I mean, campaigns can't do what they're going to do, or else they would do it themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can't. It the level of production he's offering, and so going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think I am kind of glad that I brought up the reg that you cited. Thank you, because you're right, Craig. It says, or Mr. Engel,
Craig's
it does say
we're all friends here.
Yeah. Okay. The entire amount paid to attend a fundraiser or other political event and the entire amount paid as the purchase price for a fundraising item sold by a political committee is a contribution. So back to what you were saying earlier,
if you're trying to sell a fundraising item, then you have to pay for it. And that's in line with what you just talked about with the Maloth opinion. They were trying to raise money. In this case, they're trying to get their message out and put their entire speech or whatever out into the public domain. And it's a little bit more akin to the sale of a mailing list, which we talked about yesterday. It's kind of a service almost. It's something. It's an asset that they have, which is themselves. And so they're having a sort, as you said, a bargain for exchange with the company, and they're both winning. I mean, just because they're both winning doesn't mean it's not okay. The candidate wants to get his message and his voice out there. But as Craig said, it's impossible for somebody to say, oh, yeah, I'll come video you and make it available, you know, for free. It doesn't work that way. So this is a creative way to for both sides to win. But they're providing the company with something, which is their speech and their themselves in the same way that they would in a mailing list.
Still seems like the candidate is getting something of great value and would pay for this and perhaps should pay for it, but I'm not seeing why they get paid for it. And it's not, you know, like selling the T-shirts, which, yeah, they do it to make money, but in fact, they mostly do it because they want a lot of people to be wearing their T-shirts and to be walking around advertising that they support that candidate.
I think that the reason that the candidates should be paid for this is because they are giving up something. They are giving up something to us, the right to be the exclusive broadband broadcaster of all of their campaign events.
But you said that it's not; they don't have that anywhere else anyway. So are they really giving something up? Who else is asking for that?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
If there were a bunch of folks with services like yours that were competing to be the exclusive venues for the candidates' speeches and whatever, then, I mean, honestly, I don't know why a candidate would want to give exclusive. They want their name in as many places and their photo in as many places as possible. It still seems to me that what you are providing is of such value to the candidates that they don't need to be paid. They are getting more than they're giving.
I couldn't disagree with that more, that they are getting something that they should be grateful for and shouldn't be paid for getting more than it's worth. That's not a statement that I can agree with, because the marketplace for political content is changing. And I think that we have to recognize that a candidate's appearance, his time, his speeches have value. And if a candidate committee wants to give a promoted place to someone for access to that value, then there has to be some kind of quid pro quo exchange. I don't understand why the campaigns have to be the losers here.
They're not the losers. They're getting the publicity, which is the thing that they most want.
They are getting the publicity because they've signed an agreement with us for us to give them the publicity and them to get interactive functionality from it.
Are we then going to have candidates selling their time to give speeches to corporate audiences? And I'm sure there are, you know, plenty of corporate audiences who would be happy to pay for that.
I think that's a completely separate thing. A speaking fee for a candidate to a corporate audience, I think that's completely different. It's not at all what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a media company, not a corporate audience. I'm talking about a campaign, not a candidate. I'm talking about a political event, not a speaking fee. Nothing at all to do with this.
I understand you say that, you know, these things are entirely different. I'm not sure they are.
A candidate giving a private speech to a corporation for money versus this, what I'm doing? I think there are differences. I think there are a lot of differences. I think some private corporate audience is not a media company. I think going to a campaign rally is not asking a candidate to give a speech. Paying a candidate to give a speech is not the same thing as having an offset to an operating expenditure, which is essentially what this is. That's essentially what this is it's not a contribution. It's an offset to an operating expenditure where a campaign is going to put on an event and is going to have to pay $58,000 in a build-out for an arena, and they recouped like $4,000 of it through a license fee through an exclusive provider. Remember, the campaigns don't run for free. They're creating
expenses. That's what we're here for.
Yeah, these campaigns have operating expenditures. And that's what this really is. It's an offset to an operating expenditure. To the extent that it's a net plus contribution received, that's just not possible. It's not possible. That this is an excellent way for expenses to be defrayed.
It just sounds like a contribution to me, the way you're describing it. Exactly what you're saying is exactly what is persuading me. Let me finish my sentence, okay. Please. The candidate can't, if the candidate is getting subsidies for their operating expenses, that sounds like a contribution.
Contribution is a thing of value for the purpose of influencing an election. And this company is not in the business of influencing any election. It has no intent to influence an election. Its purpose is not to influence an election. That's what a contribution is. A thing of value given for the purpose of influencing an election. And there are some limits put on it for the purpose of preventing corruption, and there are some prohibitions for the purpose of preventing corruption. We're not even in the thing of value for purpose of influencing election, let alone bumping up against a limit or a prohibition. We are, like many of the advisory opinions I cited, a business that wants to have political clients. And over the last 25 or 30 years, the commission has just routinely checked, yes, 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 if you're a business and you're doing it in an even-handed sort of way and you're motivated by profit, not by influencing the outcome of an election, you're fine. And just because we're the first ones to come up with this doesn't make it wrong.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to pick up on a point that that Commissioner Hunter was going down and just also revisit the question I'd asked you earlier about kind of the rule of thumb. And the way I understand it is that rule of thumb, as I presented it, was overly broad, not particularly precise. And according to what you had said, that payment to a political committee will be considered a contribution if that payment is for a fundraising purpose, a fundraising item, again, hat, shirts, books, what have you. And then in this particular case, this is not a payment for a fundraising item. I could see the argument being raised that there, on the one hand, I think that in your comment you said that this is not, I think that you had express some exasperation with the notion that committees would try to goose up the number of events they're going to have in order to boost the potential license fees that they could receive and therefore fatten their bank accounts, that would kind of fly in the face of political reality and probably fly in the face of how much these license fees would actually, you know, pad the coffers of the political committee. But it does seem like there does need to be some line drawn between when is a payment to a political committee, when is that deemed a fundraising fundraising payment? And when should we, where should the line be in terms of when we consider a payment to a political committee to not be? I know that you've talked about, like-kinded exchange and so forth. Maybe help me with that concept of how that line should be drawn between fundraising and non-fundraising in terms of payments made to political committees.
I think that you can look at it as a fundraising receipt, like at the top of your FEC page, a contribution, versus an other receipt or an offset to an operating expense. The contribution is pretty easy because we deal with those all the time. It's people who want to support someone, and they give them money so they can then go on and campaign. That's the motivation for the purpose of influencing an election. I want you to win, so here's $1,000, or I'm going to buy 5 T-shirts. That's a contribution. Offsets to operating expenditures or other receipts are further down the page, on the detailed summary page, and they're designed to show that there are places where political committees can receive income that don't count as contributions. And in your reporting books, you talk in there about what are other receipts, what are offsets to operating expenditures, and pretty much they're all commercial-oriented transactions, the tail end of them showing up on your report. They're not refunds, but they are money that you have been given or netted against an expense that you've incurred. Perfect example is the airline seat. That if you're a campaign with a plane, and the media wants to climb on board, you can charge them the first class seat or whatever the number might be. Now, that is a check that is being written by CBS right to Beto for president for the purpose of having their reporter on that plane so he can watch Beto and film him and maybe get an interview and go to the next event. You'd think Beto's campaign would want that for free, that kind of exposure. Sure, come on my plane. I need all the reporters that I can get on my plane. But no, the commission says you can charge for access. The first class airfare, so you can be close to the candidate and film them and get a chance at an interview and get in the front row of the next event. That's the difference between a contribution and an other receipt or an offset to an operating expenditure.
Didn't have my mic on. Any other comments, questions, Commissioner Walther?
Well, I'm still working through some of the thought process, but to me, I always come back to the issue of thing of value. What's the thing of value? This is what we're bound by. Is it a gift? Is it not a gift? What's the value? And how do you determine what the value is? And in this process, I was trying to think about how you figure out what a thing of value is or isn't, and what factors you take into consideration. So I was interested to hear what you have to say. But if it's like a regular business transaction, and like you say, it's the thing or things of value are equal, then you can figure out whether it's a campaign contribution or whether it isn't. So that's what I think is a hard thing to do in all of this, is to try and figure out how to measure the so-called thing of value.
Commissioner, that is something that I struggled with as well when we were working on this several months ago, because my fear was this, that I was going to be here talking about this. Mr. Engel, how can you make sure that that license fee isn't too high? We understand that you're going to give a license fee, and we understand that you're going to make advertising revenue from it, from the broadcast of it, and we understand that you might get some money for the functionality of it, and we understand that it'll drive the candidate support. We understand all of that is going to happen. But how can you make sure that you aren't overpaying? That's what I was most concerned about.
And that's the issue that I raised myself.
And the answer to that is this. We're going to have some of the best licensing algorithms available and licensing attorneys available to start this off, because we can't overpay. And I'll make a prediction that the license fees that are going to be paid under our proposal initially are going to be kind of low, because the market has not yet matured or become well known as to what the commercial revenue can be on a broadband channel for a candidate during or around his speeches. But we'll get there. But in talking with my clients, I said, you're going to have to turn the dial to low, because I said, this is permitted because it's a like-kind exchange. Just make sure that you err on the downside. And fortunately, because of the license industry being as pervasive as it is, we'll be able to have some access to some good talent that'll be able to help us, both computer talent and people talent. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I thought I was going to be talking about was separating the advertising revenue from the license fee to the candidates. But that appears not to be a problem because of the way in which we have structured this to not be like an affinity card relationship or any other thing where you get a percentage of the revenue if you sign up to my program. So that is one of the questions that, you know, I think we solved going in here. The question that I didn't think I was going to have to face is that the notion of license fees being not a typical media function. We all watched a licensed program last night before we went to bed, I'm sure, whatever that might be. And secondly, your precedent on fundraising, cited right here, Malothe, is do not let third parties take advantage of a media platform for raising funds to a candidate. That's your precedent. And that's exactly what I said I wasn't going to do. I said I was not going to do what you prohibited in Malothe, and I said I was going to do what's common in the industry. And you have many advisory opinions which say if you stay within the industry norms and practices, you're going to be fine. Don't weave out of the ordinary course of business. I'm in the ordinary course of business, and I'm not fundraising. I am honestly not sure what more I can do to make this as clear as I can that this is a commercial exchange by a media company, which happens many times every day, especially in politics.
Commissioner Walter?
I guess one of the things that come to mind is when you try and figure it out, and I'm truly a novice in how money's approached on these transactions, but you have to look at, as I think we have an obligation to, how could it go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
How could it go off in some direction we didn't anticipate? And so I looked at or thought about, you know, the various broadcasting companies that we see, and the divergence of opinion over what they want to broadcast and how much it's going to cost and that type of thing, and then how can we craft something here that wouldn't that could deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I'm just giving you a, you know, kind of what's on my mind when I take a look at
sure.
the proposal.
I think that if I heard you correctly, you're saying how can we make sure that there's no bias in the execution of this system 73.
Bias is a good example, and so I would say yeah, we could start with that. There's other things as well,
mm-hmm.
other indicia of gratitude.
Well, I know that I said a couple of times in System 73's advisory opinion request that we would like every candidate to be our client. So there's not a whole lot of bias there.
Right.
And in your advisory opinion, voter, which is cited in here, you made a big point of saying you're motivated by commercial profit, aren't you? Voter said yes. You said approved. That we are motivated for the same reasons that voter was motivated, that you cited in the council's draft, is that you're a for-profit corporation wanting to have political committees as clients and customers. And there is no Republican System 73. There is no Democratic System 73. There's just one. And it holds all the patents on this broadband internet connectivity blend. But I am mindful, and I will be mindful in supervising the client from here on, that don't overpay and make sure that your payments are in sync with each other. And remember, payments come not necessarily from the discretion of System 73, but from the advertising revenue that is placed on those and around those speeches. Those advertisers are going to ask System 73 the same thing they ask CBS when they are approached to put an ad on the Super Bowl. How many eyeballs do you have? And the number of eyeballs is going to be the determiner largely of the advertising revenue we're going to be able to get bidded out of, you know, Kellogg's or whomever wants to be on these screens. And also, the political committees, it is in their interest to drive their people to the System 73 channel, because the more open screens there are that we can show an advertiser, the higher we'll be able to charge that advertiser, because we'll say candidate X has a lot of people watching. Here's what our analytics show his viewership was of the last, you know, appearance. And why was that so high? Because candidate X went about shoving people and telling people, go watch me at 9:30 on System 73, pushing his people toward that. So there are safeguards and fail-safes built into this, because I know the sensitivity of the commission. You know, I've worked here. I get it.
Right.
But I also know that there is not a boogeyman behind every advisory opinion.
That's the quote of the day.
Sometimes they're just advisory opinions.
That's great.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any further questions. I really appreciate you going through this extensively and explaining this model. It's one thing to read it
right.
on a page, but to actually interact and get a much more clear understanding of what the business model is and what you envision and how this fits within the system of precedents that we have in Commission AOs. I personally could see a path forward for approving this. I'm still working through some things myself. I don't have a draft, but I think that just in reading through your proposal, your comments, and studying some of these issues out myself, but also as a result of this exchange, I might be able to get there. However, I would look to my colleagues, knowing that we all swim or sink together. I also don't want to create false hope or waste anyone's time if that would be a fruitless venture. So I just want to look to my colleagues to see whether or not that's worthwhile pursuing, creating an alternative draft and seeing what that looks like. If it's not, then, we could reach some sort of resolution today, but I just want to see what is the preference of my colleagues.
Well, I'm certainly open to looking at a way forward if it's possible. I really got a lot out of our conversations.
Thank you.
And not just you and me, but the whole conversation has been great.
I don't know. Okay. I'm not there yet, but I'm happy to consider another draft.
Okay.
And tell me what you want me to do.
If we have further follow-ups or further factual issues or questions that we might have, we can certainly convey those to you.
Sure.
But certainly appreciate you going well beyond the mark for answering our questions and giving us a much clearer understanding of what it is that this company would like to accomplish. It's been extremely helpful.
I'm happy to do it. It is. I had a lot of learning to do myself before I could speak.
Well, it's much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Same with you, Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Stefanik.
We do have a deadline.
A deadline.
May 20th, and the next open meeting is on May 23rd. So if the Commission wishes to consider this at the next open meeting, we would need a extension from counsel.
Granted.
Well, that was easy. If only it were always that easy. Thank you,
Mr.
Craig. Thank you, Mr. Engel. Okay, well, that was interesting. Bye-bye. Next item on the agenda is Commissioner Walther's motion to amend Directive 68 to establish deadlines for the timely processing of enforcement matters. Commissioner Walther.
Since there's not much to add that people here aren't totally aware of, this is just one more step, hopefully, to move us in the direction of improving our enforcement system. And the last, two or three years and motions coming and going, we've made a lot of headway in terms of transparency. So that, the public now knows, really has a very good idea of where we are and where we are not in connection with the way we are handling our enforcement. So that's fine, and it seemed to me that maybe that knowledge that we have, that others have knowledge of how we're doing and not doing, might help us move along with more alacrity, but I think we still need some work on that regard. So I would propose something along this line. I don't think anybody's going to really vote yes on this, but simply a process by which we can nudge ourselves to get something done. And I thought, by the time we got through the transparency, policies that I think are really going to be helpful, we can now identify the problem, and it turns out the problem is us, to a large degree, getting the work done. And so this proposes simply that there would be 9 months from the date of filing of the complaint to the date we would see a draft from the Office of General Counsel on a recommendation. And then there's a series of 3 months from the date of circulation. Bear in mind that at any time, if we were ever to adopt this, four votes can modify this at any time. So the time schedule really is to set something that is realistic, but also fair, not just in terms of fair in terms of getting the work done and can we get it done in time, but fair for the people who are filed the complaint, who are entitled to get action on the complaint, the people who are on the wrong end of a complaint, so that they don't have to worry about it for the next 2 or 3 years, even though we may have had our recommendation. The Office of General Counsel will sit on it for a year or two while other people want to know what's going to happen. I think this will be a way to energize us and make us realize that our job is not just to decide, but to decide it with a reasonable amount of dispatch. So I'm not going to ask for a vote on it. I know what the vote's going to be, but I might bring it up again in another session or two. And there's a little more I'd like to consider in connection with what we do when we refer our cases out to the Department of Justice and how we would deal with some of that. But overall, for us to be here and to have these cases come before us and to lose them on the statute of limitations when clearly if we'd acted with amount of reasonable dispatch is really a travesty. I don't see how we can let ourselves do that. And so I hope we can at least not let us lose a case or lose the opportunity to consider a case just because we've let the time lapse unnecessarily. So that's my pitch.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Walther, for your proposals. I would like to take a lot more time to consider them, not even just till the next meeting. And the reason for that is we have some fine people in the Office of General Counsel who are working very hard to move matters more quickly, and we've already seen some improvement. And thank you to Ms. Stevenson and Mr. Kitcher, who's here. He's our acting something of the enforcement division, and we appreciate his stepping up to take that role. It's, as some people think, it's one of the hardest in the building, and I agree.
Associate General Counsel.
Oh, thank you. Associate General Counsel for enforcement. So some good things are happening. We made some changes at the end of last year to move some of the sort of easier cases off their docket into places that might be more useful to both the committee and the commission in ADR and a new sort of campaign finance school is what I like to call it. So I think there's some good things happening, and I look forward to Mr. Kitcher and Mr. Gura and others in his division have committed to us to take some time. Again, he's new, to take some time and come up with some suggestions of how to improve the overall program. So I'd like to wait before I vote on any of these things, give him a few months to get used to the job and see how things are going. We on this side of the table proposed a number of years ago in the enforcement manual certain deadlines on the Office of General Counsel, and the people in the Office of General Counsel didn't agree with them, and neither did my colleagues. And so we have looked at this type of thing in the past and happy to take another look at it, but I'd like to give Mr. Kitcher and his team a few months to get their feet wet and come up with some suggestions. I have a lot of confidence that they will have some good ideas for us.
Well, I appreciate Commissioner Walther bringing this to the table again, just for historical perspective. I added to the agenda a proposal along similar lines that I made back in May of 2015. We have a lot of work on our docket right now. We have more cases in-house than I think we have ever had at any time in our agency's history, and we are doing it with strained resources. We have fewer attorneys. And I have asked repeatedly that my colleagues join me in requesting, in A, approving every request for enforcement attorneys when they come up to the Personnel Committee, but also in going back to Congress and asking for more lawyers, because I had a chart up on the screens at the end of last year that showed that we have three times the, looking back at a period of time, I think it was sometime within the last 10 years for a comparison point, we have three times as many cases and two-thirds the lawyers working on them. And there are also a number of really excellent lawyers that commissioners are borrowing from the Office of General Counsel. They're on detail to our offices, and I have somebody in my shop, so I'm not blameless on this. I have tried not to do that too often, but sometimes it seems unavoidable. But that leaves them shorthanded. I think it's a great opportunity for our OGC attorneys to get the experience of working in commissioners' offices and seeing how the sausage gets made up here. But some of those folks have been gone for a long time from OGC on extended details, and I think we ought to empower OGC to replace them, at least on a one-for-two basis. I've offered my colleagues a sale price of one for two let them replace one out of every two people that are detailed somewhere else, because they need more. And we are getting reports up to us for decision at a pace that I have not seen, I think, in my time here. Every week there are, it seems like there's a dozen new ballots. And some of them are pretty straightforward and are easy, but others are complicated and hard. So there is a lot of work going on downstairs. I think it could be done better. I asked, was it last year or the year before, I asked Ms. Stevenson and our then head of enforcement to come up with a set of proposals for us on what they thought would help. And I was ready to endorse virtually every one of them. Not every commissioner was. So we, haven't had support for hiring more lawyers. We haven't had support for all of the ideas that our lawyers have suggested to us that they think would help them process cases more quickly. And there's us. There are cases that sit on commissioners' desks for way too long. There are cases that have been held up by commissioners for literally years on end. And I have said this before. I think that is unacceptable. I wish there was some way to write a directive that would tie commissioners' hands in a way that they wouldn't be able to do that. But we have not been able to come up with that yet, and if we did, I don't think we would have the votes for it. So I share Commissioner Walther's concerns on this, and will continue to be happy to work with him or any member of the commission, and all of, in fact, we would need to work with all of the commission, because everything has to be unanimous these days, to try to address some long, long-standing problems. I also am delighted with Mr. Kitcher having stepped up to take on one of the most thankless tasks, perhaps the most thankless task in the building. It's a huge workload. He came over from our litigation division, which I think is probably good training, because litigators get their briefs in on time. So I know that he's bringing that sense of time sensitivity with him in his new role, and he and I have had many productive discussions about timeliness already, and I'm sure we will continue to have those discussions, but I don't think, because we happen to have someone who is relatively new in that role, that we have to wait to address longstanding problems in the timely processing of complaints. I completely agree with Commissioner Walther. It's unfair to the people who are the subject of the complaints, it's unfair to the complainants, and it's unfair to the public, and it's unfair to everyone in the campaign finance community who is trying to figure out where the lines are and is waiting to see. They hear about these complaints getting filed, and they don't see any resolution of them, so they just don't know what's going on. You know, does the commission think this is a problem? Does the commission not think this is a problem? Is it being investigated, or is it just sitting around waiting? So I think this is a huge, long-standing problem for the commission, and I support any effort to make improvements in that area. So Commissioner Walther has said he's not asking for a vote on this today. Any other comments on this? Well, then, we will move along to the perhaps not unrelated topic of meeting dates. You know, it's taken months to get the meeting dates for the rest of the year, which is a little bit disappointing. I had hoped to have a more aggressive schedule for the rest of the year. I think that it would be helpful for us to meet more often because a lot of decisions just don't get made until we sit down at the table and have a vote. The commission didn't always work that way. The commission used to, way back when, vote on 73-hour tally. We would vote on, I don't know if there's anybody, well, there's a couple of folks in the room who can still remember those days, where a ballot would come up and commissioners would vote within 72 hours, within 3 days. And actually make substantive votes. And if commissioners wanted to make edits to the factual and legal analysis that went behind, that supported some of the recommendations, they would shoot an email around to their colleagues, and it would often be resolved before the next meeting, and we'd have only the most substantive matters that really required every member of the commission to sit down together and hash them out would end up on the agenda for the executive session. And, you know, we'd have those meetings every 2 weeks. We would clear the docket before lunch. We don't do business like that anymore. And since it seems to take meetings to make decisions, I think we ought to have more of them. I think we are paid by the taxpayers to work full time, and 4 meeting dates a month is not enough to get our work done. So I had proposed a lot more meeting dates and could not get agreement to do pretty much anything other than the historical twice a month, Tuesday, Thursday schedule. We are meeting in exec session on Thursdays in addition to Tuesdays, which we don't do all the time in order to try and move cases forward. I was able to get agreement for 1 additional exec session in June, but the rest of it is pretty much the way it's always been. But there's only 4 of us, so we need all 4 commissioners to agree to show up, either in person or electronically or on the phone. I guess we're not doing it electronically by email, but we've got to have commissioners present either in person or by phone to meet, and these are the dates that commissioners have been willing to agree to meet. So that's the schedule for the rest of the year. Mr. Hunter?
I'm tired of arguing about this, but just wanted to say that having more meeting dates doesn't mean that we're necessarily more productive, and I'll leave it at that for today.
That's true. It requires people to show up to the meetings prepared to vote on the matters on the agenda.
Can we just move on? I mean, we're tired of just...
Tired of hearing about it. I'm sorry to bore you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there are not any more comments, I'll move approval of the meeting dates for the second half of this year. I set forth an agenda document number 19-19-A. Oh, I see that.
I'll support that, but I do think maybe we could take a look at some point in the near future and see and really think about that. And if we think we can meet 4, 5, or 6 more times in the year and get the cases set up so that we can be more efficient, I think we should take a look at that. But and I'll certainly vote for this today.
The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the meeting dates as set forth in Agenda Document 19-19-A. there any further discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And the ayes have it. The motion passes unanimously. Mr. Palmer, do we have any management or administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
Thank you. That being the case, this meeting is adjourned.